This is Keith Scott Allen of Otaku.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on July 7th, 2010. Tonight's guest is Julie Lerman. She's been developing software since the mid-80s, lives in Vermont with her husband Rich, spends a lot of time writing a book about the Entity Framework, and she started the Vermont .NET User Group in 2002. Still running that?
Yeah. Yep.
Awesome. So the topic tonight's Entity Framework 4.0, and for anyone that hasn't worked with the Entity Framework for as yet, what would be some good reasons to try it out now? What's new?
So what's new in Entity Framework? There's actually the Entity Framework, the new version, the .NET 4 version, which we call Entity Framework 4, because, you know, everybody missed version 2 and version 3, of course. There's actually been a lot of stuff added to the framework to make it so much more usable. Just on a broad look at some of the new support or new features or improvements would be first in the category of just working with a designer. There's been a ton of improvements working with the designer. And in the runtime itself, there's lots and lots of little things, but I think that some of the biggest things, at least the things that I've been focused on lately, have been the POCO support, which opens up a whole new slew of possibilities for programming with Entity Framework, and also additional support for working with disconnected entities with the change tracking. It's a real problem for anybody who's doing web development or working with services. So those are the big areas. The actual list, it's pretty long if you just want to go into every little thing. But for me, seriously, the POCO support is probably the most interesting new big feature with the Entity Framework. And Scott Allen, I know you've actually just recently written a white paper that highlights some of the great things you can do with the new POCO support of the persistence ignorance with Entity Framework and unit testing.
Right. I was looking at it from a testing perspective. Can I use this and write decent unit tests?
Right. And what's interesting now with some of the new support that's in there, I'm coming from a database first world. I'm a lot more like people on the team, right? It's the data access team, right? These are data people who really do think about database first. And so we're all learning. We're all coming into this new world and learning about persistence ignorance and learning about domain-driven development in response to a lot of what people were asking for with Entity Framework. And when I say we, I just want to make sure people understand I don't work at Microsoft, but I also do come from that world of database first, database focused kind of development. So what's really cool now is with the new stuff, yeah, I'm learning. So I'm learning and writing about working with repositories and, you know, domain-driven development and things like that. But I'm just learning those things and bringing in the Entity Framework experience. What I love seeing is people coming from the other side of the fence with the kind of experience that you have and saying, oh, now, you know, how can I plug Entity Framework into that? And that's one of the things I've been trying to do is talk to those people, right? And say, okay, you've got that domain expertise. You really know unit testing, you know, agile this or domain driven development that. So here's what's in Entity Framework. Let me show you what I can show you. And then you can take that and go do all your brilliant stuff with it. And if I'm lucky, some of it comes back and I get to learn more too.
Yeah, what's interesting, and I use the term interesting in the way that Oren would use the term interesting, is that I think a lot of the ORMs that have been out there have come from people or teams or people that have been not focused on data first, you know, not database first people. And so those ORMs work entirely differently than the first version of EF, which came from a team that was really thinking about data first.
And they weren't even calling it an ORM. When Entity Framework came out, everybody said, oh, it's an ORM. And they said, no, it's really not. It's ORM is in there. It has some ORM capability, but it's much more than that. Now, you know, that messaging evolved as Entity Framework evolved and everybody's understanding of what they were trying to accomplish and and Microsoft, any framework team, really trying to embrace all types of development and all types of developers. I think that that message has evolved, and they're saying, yeah, it is an ORM.
Right. Let's drill into the POCO thing a little bit. In the first version of the framework, you pretty much had to start with a database schema. Unless you wanted to write your own XML, I don't think there was any way to start with a blank slate and build things up and generate a schema or anything like that. But that's completely different now in EF4, right?
Well, in fact, in Visual Studio 2008 with the Entity Framework Designer, you could start with a blank designer, a blank model on the designer surface and create entities and associations and inheritance and build the whole model. The problem is once you had done that, that was the end of the line.
There was no way to generate your database out of that.
There was no way to create the database schema, the SSD, the store schema that's part of the metadata. You couldn't create the rest of the metadata. That's what the problem is. So Entity Framework is dependent on not only the conceptual model, but another section of the metadata is a description of the database. That's the store schema. And then in between, there's the mappings, right? So you could create the conceptual model, no problem, but there was no way to create the rest of the metadata so that you could map back to the database and Entity Framework could do what it does, do its job. So, and I even tried it. Right. But it was just way too hard. So now, yeah, that's really huge for people who are, you know, not database first. I tend to think of that as people who are not starting with legacy databases, because my experience is if you're starting with a legacy database, you kind of can't help being somewhat database first, because it's kind of might be driving things. Now, mm-hmm. that again is my kind of database background showing through. And the more people I talk to, I'm starting to learn more about that, you know, it's not just for database first, isn't the only way to go when you're doing a kind of a brownfield application when you do have a legacy database.
But some of that comes from the fact that there's no real like migrations, right? I mean, because when I'm showing this to people that have worked with other database systems, they'll say, okay, I generate my model and now I want to advance my model. How do I migrate? And then that's where I'll say, well, at that point, you've got a database, so you really need to switch over to database first.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense for a lot of scenarios. And with database first, you can still totally customize the model. Right. So database first gives you a stake in the ground with the model. Right. And it is just a total reflection of the database when you get that first model. But then you can start customizing it and the mappings will continue to let you get back and forth to the database. So it's not evil, you know, and it's not that you're just making a rubber stamp of the database and you're still stuck with it. The whole point of the entity data model is so that you can have something, you know, depending on how far you want to go, you could have the model represent your domain model, or you can use it strictly as a part of your data layer and use it as a step along the way. But the entity data model doesn't at all need to look like your database model because of all the customization. So that's still database first. In Visual Studio 2010 with a new designer, we can now start with designing that model on the surface and then actually do something with it, which is generate the database schema. And at the same time, that does create all that metadata for you. But you can generate database schema. And since I'm so often talking to either teams with DBAs or directly to DBAs or database designers, then I generally say the next step after you've created that DDL is to take that DDL, take that file, and bring it with a bag of M&Ms or something to the DBA or the database designer and say, okay, here's kind of what we're looking for. But the other way of using that is, you know, take that DDL and run it against your database server and create a new database. Because there's a lot of people who are very happy doing things that way. And all the database people I know are screaming their heads off right now. No, you can't do that.
So I'm actually coming at this from an interesting perspective. I've actually been rather subdued in my opinion about Entity Framework because I have literally learned nothing about it. I have never written a DD whatever you call. I haven't opened the designer. Nothing. I know Zippo.
You know, there's a lot of people who've never used Entity Framework and they still have a lot to say about it. So I'm impressed.
But in my experience with other data modeling tools, and not just Microsoft ones, is that once you get on the design surface, you have to walk a very narrow path. And once you get off of that path, there's a lot of pain and there's a lot of, you know, oh, crap, did that just overwrite my generated code? And, you know, hey, how come I can't get this to do that? And so I'm just wondering if you've seen a lot of that in EF, or if there was a lot in one and there's not in two.
So you're talking specifically about using the designer to build that model, not what happens in the runtime after the fact, but how come I can't do this mapping or what happened to the thing I created?
Or yeah, or right? You know, I can't quite do them. I can't quite make this fit my legacy database that I have, that, you know, right, this medical research database that has been around for 15 years and has migrated through several systems.
Sure.
I can't quite get the designer to do what I need. And then once I get off of that, then I'm in this world of pain where I'm constantly overwriting things and being overwritten. And
I've seen a lot of that. So a couple of points to be made about that. First of all, as an example, I have a client that I'm working with who is stuck with, I have to say easily, the most horrific database design. And I'm not a database designer, right? But it is the worst database design I've ever seen in my life. And I've been working with data and databases a long time. It was originated from somebody whose only experience was with flat files. And it is just awful. And they're stuck with it because they've got a lot of legacy applications built on top of it. So even though they're moving forward and they want to build new applications, they can't break all those old applications. So they're really stuck with this database. So if that kind of speaks to the problem you're talking about with your medical database, right? There was just no way to build a model and map back to that data in the way the structure of that data was. And in that scenario, they weren't aware of something that you can do with a model, which is you can actually use database views as the source of your entities rather than tables. So since they owned the database and it wasn't a problem for them to go in and add views to it, right? They couldn't change the table structure because there's all these other applications that are dependent on it, but they added views into the database. And with a combination of views and stored procedures, we built the whole model that way. So that's a really interesting thing a lot of people aren't aware of that you can do. So we weren't bound to, in that case, the nightmare of the schema of the database. And they're still able to write their applications against it, which is really, really cool. The other thing you were asking about was overwriting things. So with Entity Framework, and even in the first version of the designer with Visual Studio 2008 Service Pack 1, you can update your model. That's actually something you can't do with Link to SQL, at least not out of the box. Maybe there's some tool you can use for that. But if you make a change to the database, you can update the model from the database, and it will, depending on what kinds of changes those are, they will be reflected in the model, and you won't trash the model at all. So if you've made customizations to the conceptual model and then you update it from the database, maybe to bring in new fields from a table or new tables, that won't hurt all the work that you've already done. There is one place where it is a real problem, though, because there are some kinds of customizations. There's not a lot, but there's still a series of kind of more edge case customizations that you might want to do to the store schema. So not the conceptual model, not the model that you're programming against, but the schema in the metadata that describes your database. And those get overwritten. And that's really, really aggravating. I just try to avoid them as much as I can because there's no easy way to merge those changes back in. So does that address some of those questions?
I think so, mostly. I mean, it's one of those things where I'll have to use it, and then I will inevitably find the crack that they missed in their
testing. Yeah, well, there are a few. Like one of
and
one,
I find that in every framework I use.
Sure.
Practically.
One that's kind of frustrating is unique foreign keys, right? So if you have a relationship between two tables, and it's a primary key foreign key relationship, but the foreign key has to be unique, there is a way to map that, but there's some limitations about that. You know, so that's kind of frustration. And especially the real frustration in that one comes if, because there is a way around it, but if you use that method to get around it and you're using RIA services, you're screwed, unfortunately, because you have to go back to the old way of doing the associations. And when I say the old way, in .NET 3.5, the way associations were built, relationships between entities, it was all done in the mappings, and there are no foreign keys exposed in the entities. Now in .NET 4, we've got foreign key support, and the default for building models is to have the foreign key as a scalar property right in the entity. And that makes creating the relationships so much easier. So the relationships are built in the model itself. So to get around the problem with the unique foreign keys, you have to go back to the old way. You have to take the foreign key out of the entity and use the kind of behind the scenes mapping that creates the association. And of course, the first client that asked me, oh, how do I do this? And I said, oh, no problem. Just, you know, get rid of the foreign key and do it this other way. And so, you know, we did the whole thing and they're like, oh, that's great. But now my RIA services doesn't work. I'm like, oh, you're using RIA services. Well, RIA services absolutely requires foreign key relationships. So there are things like that are frustrating. Another real biggie is just the difficulty of working with large models in the designer. That's really a problem. It's just unmanageable, right, to have lots and lots of entities. So that's something people ask about a lot. And there's one approach to it, which I think is probably the smartest, is don't put everything into one huge model. You can really think of your models as different domains, maybe different transactions or different pieces of your application instead of one big, huge thing, and then just build multiple models.
Especially like you're saying, now that the foreign keys are exposed, that seems more practical.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Absolutely. That's huge. Another interesting thing is, I don't know if you've seen the work that LLBL Gen Pro has done with a new version. And, you know, Franz has, even though, you know, he has his own ORM, there's so much knowledge there about mapping and designing and ORMs that they've taken that and created a designer for Entity Framework 4. And essentially what the designer in LLBL Gen Pro does is says, let's not try to use a design surface because that's where all the problems are, right? To have something visual. So they don't have a picture of the model. You don't work with it that way. It's more property windows. So for really big models, even if you're going to break up the models, there's really nice support in there for doing that. It's a little more work to learn, right? Because it's pretty intensive. You can really get very granular with some of the things you're doing with that. But, you know, it's great to see new approaches instead of people just struggling with, oh, but I have 750 tables in my database, therefore I need to have all 750 of them represented in one model and on a design surface and try to deal with that. Pause.
So,
a pregnant pause.
So where I was trying to go many minutes ago, and we got off on a tangent, which is perfectly fine.
Oh, me?
But yeah, all of us was the POCO thing. So you have this model, and it doesn't matter if you did model first or you did database first, but you have this model, and most people think of the model as something that's going to generate a bunch of messy code. That's different now too, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting when talking to you about models, I always stop and think, okay, is Scott talking about the actual entity data model, or are you just talking about models, right? Like domain models? But I think you're talking about the entity data model here and the code, the XML and the code generation that happens, correct?
Right. I have something pretty in my Visual Studio Designer. There's an EDMX file there. I know it's XML.
Right.
And by default, it's code generating just stuff that I don't like.
Absolutely. Right. So the default code gen that happens out of the box. So the Visual Studio is essentially like this anyway, right? It shoots for defaults to make things out of the box easy for people to use. And if you want to do something differently, then you have to make a little extra effort and you can have a lot more control over what's going on. So Entity Framework Designer works the same way, right? So the default out of the box is it creates these classes that inherit from an object of Entity Framework, which is called the Entity Object, and that object enables your classes to participate in an Entity Framework with very little effort on your part, relatively speaking. But, you know, if you don't want to have all of that happening, it's not just that it inherits from Entity Objects, and that's a problem for a lot of people who don't, you know, you want to really have separation in your code, right? So you don't want to have my classes. These are my classes, right? Like, I don't want my classes inheriting from your stuff. So that, to begin with, is a problem for people. But also just all that those classes need to just kind of automatically participate with the Entity Framework and get the change tracking and the querying and all the relationship management and all of that. So the team worked really, really hard to enable developers to not have to be dependent on that entity object and all of that generated code. And so there's two pieces to this POCO support. One is that the context got smarter, right? So instead of the context waiting for those objects to notify it about everything, right? And the only way the objects could do that was from inheriting from this entity object. Instead now, or should I say in addition, the context is a lot smarter, and the context has a way of kind of looking down at those classes and finding out what's going on in them. So one piece of the POCO support is the fact that the context got so much smarter. But the other part of it is that we've got a huge amount of control now over the code generation. Before, in Visual Studio 2008, there was a proprietary code generator that the Entity Framework team wrote. And it was, you know, not easy to learn. I actually don't know anybody who used it. I'm sure a number of people did. But it wasn't an easy thing to do if you wanted to change how your classes worked. And again, it's a two-part solution here, right? Because the fact that the object context is way smarter allows us to also take advantage of the fact that now we have more control over the code generation. So the way we have more control over the code gen is they threw away their proprietary code generator and are now using T4, which was a text template transformation toolkit that's part of the DSL toolkit, and it's been in Visual Studio since Visual Studio 2008. So if you've never used that before, perhaps you're familiar with other code generators such as CodeSmith, and essentially it knows how to read some kind of a text file, right? XML file is nicely formatted for that purpose. And then you have another file that has like a rules engine, and it looks almost like markup, like ASP markup in a way. And then it works actually, another thing people might be familiar with is XML and XSLT transformation. So it's the same kind of thing. So XSLT has all the rules of what you want to do to the file that has the key data in it. So that would be the XML file, and it transforms it into another file. So T4 does that. You have the data file, and in this case, that's going to be the XML metadata that represents the conceptual schema of your entity data model. And you have a template, the T4 template, that says, here's what I want you to spit out. And then you have T4, which is the engine that drives all of that. So the code gen, therefore, is now done with T4 templates. And because of that, we can have templates other than the default template. The default template spits out the entity objects and all that excessive code that allows people to just use Entity Framework right out of the box without having to think about anything. And again, I say that with a grain of salt. There's, you know, my first book was 800 pages long for a reason. So there was a few things to think about. But still, with a code generator, now we can have additional templates. So a lot of us, what we did, as soon as we got our hands on this, we took the default template and started stripping it down and stripping it down and stripping it down to make cleaner classes, like POCO classes. That was a lot of work to do. And T4 is not the easiest to work with right now because, well, there isn't even a built-in editor for Visual Studio, but there are some extensions you can use. You can get them really easily with the Visual Studio extensions, like Tangible's T4 editor. But still, it's a lot of work. It was kind of a bear to do. And now the Entity Framework team has a couple of really simplified POCO templates, and you can just install them right with the extension manager. So right out of that additional box, right, these additional POCO templates, you can use those and get much simpler classes, and they're the POCO classes. Or you can start with those because they're much lighter weight. There's much less stuff in them than the default template, and you can use those and just edit from there because it's a lot easier to get to start with those simpler T4 templates. So you have a lot of control over the code that's generated now. And Entity Framework, because the context is smarter, is able to deal with the POCO classes that you can generate.
Just as an aside, that's really good timing with Visual Studio 2010 and the extension manager coming along with that, because the templates shipped after, I believe they shipped after Visual Studio 2010 had shipped, but it's a no-brainer to just go out there and search for POCO and download them and then write into, you just add template item.
They're
and,
just there.
Yeah.
It takes 30 seconds.
I know you have a screencast about that on the MSDN data, and then Scott also had written about that on his white paper, but for listeners that haven't tried that, it's brain dead simple. Like, I was imagining, okay, I'll have to install this thing and I'll have to go, you know, do all this setup, and it was like, just like you're saying, it's brain dead simple. It's so easy.
Nice. Even I can do it. No, I mean, it's just, it's all built in. You know, Microsoft really, I didn't pay attention to all that VSX stuff, right? The Visual Studio extensions, because I'm not writing extensions. So I never paid attention to it. So I didn't really know what was going on there. And when I started using that in Visual Studio 2010 and using it, right? What's the definition of using it? The definition of using it is, you know, in Visual Studio 2010, going to the tools menu, dropping down tools, clicking on extensions, it opens up a screen, and then you can say, well, you can look at what you've already got installed. And if you're just starting, you have none. Then you go to the Visual Studio Gallery, right? It's just another option on that extension manager. And there's hundreds of cool extensions that you just click on, install, and now they're part of Visual Studio. Really, really cool. And Microsoft has written a whole bunch of them too. And it's a great way for them to plug in stuff that they weren't able to get in the box for RTM. I'm a big fan of it.
They're cool. Very cool. Yeah. So one of the things that I did when I worked on that paper was to just completely turn off code generation, write all of my classes and entities by hand, and then go back and work up an EDMX in the designer to get the thing, to get those classes persisted in a database. So, you know, no code generation at all. But it does seem like there's one additional piece missing for someone
that
just wants... Well, no. There's a piece missing for someone that doesn't want to muck with EDMX. They just want to write some classes and then maybe by convention have those classes persisted, or write some code that does the mapping, much like Fluent and Hibernate. You can set up a mapping that way instead of messing around with the XML files.
This sounds like a softball headed my way, Scott. There is something for those people. It's not in Visual Studio 2010. It didn't make it into Entity Framework 4, but it is currently a CTP, and it's a very active CTP that the team is working on. The technology is called Code First, and it was originally called Code Only. People might know it by that name. And the reason it was changed to Code First was so that it's so that the team can refer to database first, model first, and code first, right? So they just kind of all line up and it makes it easy for people to get all that. And the reason that I know this is for the people who are interested in Flu and Hibernate or Q curious about something that's like that is because I've heard so many people look at Code First and say, oh, wow, that's a lot like Fluent and Hibernate. So I'm, again, learning the backwards way. So what Code First does, you know, just backing up a little bit, the metadata that I've talked about that's represented in that EDMX file, those all that XML that represents the conceptual model, that description of the store, and the mappings in between, that's critical, critical metadata for Entity Framework. That's what Entity Framework uses every time it tries to take your link to entities query and transform it into a store query. And whenever the data, the results come back from the database, that metadata is used again to transform what's in the data reader into the objects, right? So it's used not just in those places, but it's used a lot more. But it's absolutely critical for the most important functionality of Entity Framework. So the question was, you know, how can people who don't want to deal with a physical model still take advantage of Entity Framework? And the way Code First works is you design, you create your classes, and this works convention over configuration. So let's just assume everything works out and you don't have to do any extra configuration. So you write your classes, you run your application, and at runtime, Entity Framework or the this Code First API will read the classes and create on the fly, it'll create the XML metadata in memory. So now that metadata is there, that's all Entity Framework needed, and it can just keep doing the way it normally works. It doesn't have to do anything special. So it's convention over configuration. There's absolutely, you know, rules your code has to follow, your classes have to follow in order for Entity Framework or the CTP to be able to do that job. But, you know, that, of course, made lots of people go, oh, well, I don't like it then if it makes me follow rules. So, you know, but that's what convention over configuration is. Don't forget the configuration part. So where your classes don't line up with the needs of Code First, then you can just use some configurations. And they're not attribute configurations. It's not declarative. It's actually a configuration that you can do right in the code to just supplement what Entity Framework can learn from the classes. And I think that's the part that people are equating to Fluent and Hibernate, or are saying was influenced by Fluent and Hibernate. The fact that it's not declarative. Am I an Hibernate expert, Scott Kuhn, maybe? Does that sound
right? Don't look
right
at me. I just spent 3 days banging my head against Fluent and Hibernate.
Well, come on, but you're Scott Kuhn. You should, you know, 3 days should be enough, right?
Yeah.
So this is what I don't know. I don't know exactly which piece of it. I know the fact that it's configurable, so it's fluid, right? And you can take your classes and still add this configuration to help make it look the way Entity Framework needs it to look. And
well,
also,
yeah. So with Fluent and Hibernate, you basically can let it make assumptions. So if you name your POCO class properties, the virtual properties, the same as entities in your domains in the database, then you know it makes the assumption that if you have something called, you know, name in your table, that it probably maps to a name on whatever object or class you've specified in your mappings.
Right. Right. So, like it'll work with, for example, for primary keys, if you've got something called ID. Or if it's a combination of the class name and the word ID, it'll presume by convention that that's going to be the primary key. And if you have something else that's something that is supposed, you want to be your primary key, your identity key, but it doesn't follow those patterns, then you can use the additional configurations to say, hey, that thing there, that's my primary key. I know it's named funny, but, you know, that's what I want you to use. And there's a lot of things you can influence that way. For example, with inheritance, oh, I think that with Code First, the default it will create is TPH, table per hierarchy inheritance. But then you can use the configuration to say, no, on that one, I really want it to be TPT, right? So create a separate, you know, don't just put a Boolean into the table for me, but please create a separate table. So there's a ton you can do with the configurations. And right now we've got CTP3. CTP4 is coming out, and CTP4 is going to be even smarter about the convention. So it's going to be a lot more flexible, and there will be less things that you have to configure, especially with things that should be a little more obvious, like certain types of relationships and things like that, it's going to be a lot smarter about. And the interesting thing about Code First is that the domain-driven developers are really interested in it, right? Because that's kind of where it came from.
So I'm looking at the history of Internet Explorer here. And one came out in 95. One and two both did. Then three in 96. Then four in 97. So there was 2 years between the release of one and four. And then EF came out like in January, and then in December, four came out. No, that's not true.
Wait, you didn't see two and three?
One came out on August 2008, something like that.
Right, and but then, you didn't see two and three?
I told you, I have never looked at this thing, so they could have had 20 versions and 12 CTVs.
There was no two and three. The first version of Entity Framework, we all called Entity Framework 1. The second version of Entity Framework is the one that's part of .NET 4, and they wanted to call it Entity Framework 4 to align with .NET 4 and ASP.NET 4. And
Windows Phone 4. Oh, Windows see? Phone. That's
and Windows, yeah, Windows 7 oh. 4. Wait, what?
That's
no?
That's
and
the
SQL Server 4. That's what it was.
I'm trying Windows not to use 49. The word marketing. That's the
Well, we have to ask these things because you know we're going to get calls from recruiters looking for Entity Framework 2, 3, and 4 experience.
Exactly. Right. No, there's 1 and there's 4, and you didn't miss anything.
So hopefully the next...
Will
it be 16 or 7?
I don't know what the next one will... I'm assuming it'll be whatever the version of .NET is, and I would guess that .NET's going to be .NET 5, so I would imagine it's going to be called EF5. But the joke that people were saying was they just wanted people to think it was had evolved and it was a more stable product by giving it a higher number.
Like Java.
But that wasn't the reason.
Like Java going from 1.5 to 6.
Well, no, because they went like, yeah, that was kind of screwed up too. But they had been going on. They had originally thought that Java 1.2 was going to be called Java 2. And then for some reason they stuck with the one dot notation. Because I lived through that part and I was totally confused because I got all these books on Java 2 and then 1.2 came out. And I was like, oh my God, they got 0.8 more versions to go through.
Well, what version is node.js at?
It is at
0.0.3.0.0.0.0.
Got into the conversation for you, Scott.
There always has to be JavaScript. Can we call Entity Framework objects from JavaScript? No. Then it's worthless to me. So going back to the whole EF1 to 4.0 jump. So back in when 1.0 was released, there was a huge vote of no confidence kerfuffle. And I say it was a kerfuffle, but there were 861 people that signed to this thing online. And it wasn't just, I mean, a lot of people say, oh, it's just the alt.NET troublemakers. But, I mean, there were some people on there that are pretty mainstream and, you know, are not the usual rabble-rousers who just hate everything. In fact, there's a signature here, number 319, if you look. Someone much more important than that. If you go and you look at signature number 319 on the page there.
I don't happen to have that page bookmarked, so you might as well just tell me who it is.
Do you want to tell her, Kay Scott?
Isn't me? I know I signed it. I didn't know where I ended up on it.
Yeah, I just noticed that. So it's not just, you know, people that supposedly hate Microsoft and what. And I was just wondering, you know, what were your thoughts on it? And
most,
do you think it changed
of those
the
people
direction?
Don't hate Microsoft though. I mean, that's what alt.net is. Alt.net, they want to use .NET. They just want to use it differently, right? So they're not Microsoft haters.
And so I was just wondering what your thoughts were on it, and if you thought that it actually influenced the whole, you know, second version of EF,
I don't think it did. The message was already loud and clear to Microsoft. The vote of no confidence, in my opinion, came pretty far after the fact. That's my opinion. A lot of the same people had already had direct conversations, if you can call them conversations. Some of them were conversations. They had been discussing it with the Entity Framework team. And I really think a lot of those discussions happened long before the vote of no confidence came out. And, you know, the team was well on their way. I mean, if you think about the development lifecycle for releasing Visual Studio, you know, they're like done a year before they even give us a beta, right? Because they've got all these crazy time frames and things that they have to do. So I absolutely, the alt.net community had a huge influence on Entity Framework 4. I'm just saying, I don't think that the timing of the vote of no confidence was what impacted it. So I think the other part of your question wasn't just, do you think it had an influence, but just kind of what I thought about it and what I thought about.
What did you think about 1.0 versus 4?
Was broadcast. There's a lot of people in that group that I have an enormous amount of respect for, and I've been learning from. And I actually, you know, there's been a lot of kerfluffle lately, to use your term, which I love, about kind of alt.net. I think our friend Rob has lit a couple of little fires under some conversations. I think alt.net did great things, not just for Entity Framework, but just for waking people up. I personally learned a lot because of them, because of all of, you know, the part of it was the ranting and the screaming, yes, but it wasn't all ranting and screaming. There was so much information there about, look, we just have some really, you know, we have these great ideas about how to write software in a great way. And there was all this passion there. And that caught my attention. And that also got me really curious, because I too came from this data world, right? We're database first. And just thinking about writing software in a different way, really just a lot of the things they were saying and talking about really caught my attention and my curiosity. I got curious about persistence ignorance. I got curious about POCOs. I got curious about testing, right? And now the Entity Framework has all of that capability in it, I'm having so much fun really learning about these things and trying to share them with other people who are coming from my world of not really understanding all of that stuff. So I think they did a great thing.
You know, I read on the internet somewhere that Scott Kuhn is responsible for killing alt.net.
Yeah, that was all me.
Well, that was a covered discussion I was referring to.
I'm bitter.
Was that when he set up that fake Scott Belware account?
No. That was totally separate. I don't think that had anything to do with it. No.
All right. We're getting low on time. I know John still has a question, and then we'll have to take one question.
You had a real question, John, like a technical question, right?
I had a couple of technical questions, but they're quick. One was the whole about the POCO. Like, okay, so there's this range. There's the model first or database first, where you're just kind of generating things. And then there's the code first or code only, where you're doing, you know, you're writing classes and just putting, you're configuring them. And then,
right, there's no physical model.
Okay, and then POCO, the idea with POCO is you're going in, you're designing something, but then you're using a template that's going to generate a pretty lightweight.
Yes and no. I mean, that's not, the POCO support is kind of, first of all, the POCO support is underneath the code first. Code first couldn't work without the POCO support. So POCO support is not a separate thing.
Okay.
Right? So the POCO support, and you can use POCO support even if you're using database first. So whether you're using database first or model first, you're still going to have a physical model, and you're going to generate some code from that. The question is, are you going to generate entity objects, or are you going to generate POCOs? Or you can handwrite POCOs, right? You have that also. You can turn off the code generation, and you can just write your own classes. So if what you're using as your classes, whether they were code generated or not, along with the model, in conjunction with that model, if they do not inherit from entity object, then you're going to be using the POCO. You're going to be taking advantage of the POCO support. And there's extra things you have to do to benefit from that.
Okay. And and so one of the...
Does that help?
It does help. That is
sorted out a little?
Yeah, okay. Because my experience mostly with the POCO so far had been, you know, other than reading about it, but I'd actually, my firsthand experience had been downloading the POCO entity generator template and generating classes.
Right. And, you know, probably the classes that you generated from that POCO template, I bet are very different than the classes that K Scott wrote by hand.
Uh-huh.
And the reason is that there's two flavors of POCO support. One is using just clean POCOs, totally clean POCOs, and you're absolutely dependent on the object context leveraging its new brains, right? Its new capabilities of rather than waiting for the POCOs to communicate with it, it goes and looks at the POCOs and sees what's going on there, right? That's the, you know, keeping things in the right direction instead of having your classes having to know about the object context. So clean POCOs. And we call that snapshot, I want to say notification, but that doesn't make sense. I can't even remember. The detection, snapshot detection. Or it has to do with the change tracking and the fact that it's the context that will be taking a snapshot of what's going on in the classes in order for it to figure out what's, you know, what the state of the classes are. So it's doing its change tracking and it can do persist stuff back to the database. So those are the clean classes. The next level of POCO support, and this is what you're going to get by default with those T4 templates. And what you can do is edit the templates to change this, of course. But there's a trick that's used by making every property, and I want to clarify that and qualify that in a minute, every property in the class virtual, and in Visual Basic, that's the same as overridable. By making every property in the class virtual, it's kind of a trick. When at runtime, Entity Framework will see that, and that will be flag, so to speak, for Entity Framework to create a dynamic runtime proxy that wraps around the class. And the proxy has all of the same capabilities as that entity object. So now your completely POCO class is wrapped at runtime by a dynamic proxy, and that dynamic proxy communicates with, sends notifications to the context. So you don't have to, a developer doesn't have to do that extra work to get the context to take snapshots of and do detection of what's going on in the classes. And again, what that does is it's another kind of out of the box. It just makes everything work the way people were used to it working with the entity objects, but now it's doing it with POCOs. And you could take those POCOs and you could, you know, build more separated architectures and build unit tests, et cetera, just as long as you don't mind having that virtual keyword in there. It also, having the virtual in there also allows your navigation properties to do the lazy loading, because lazy loading is new in Entity Framework also. A regular POCO, like the one that I'm assuming Scott wrote, probably doesn't have lazy loading. You have to make it virtual. You have to at least make those navigation properties virtual to get that. So those are the two levels of support. One is just, you know, your class is clean, and then you're depending on the context to do these snapshots of what's going on in the classes. And the other is doing that trick of using the virtual properties. And then once you've done that, you get the dynamic proxy. And now the classes, again, know how to notify the context so you don't have to do the extra work. Now, remember I said that I wanted to qualify my statement that you have to mark every property virtual. It's the properties that match the properties in your entity. So your POCO class, in order for the POCO support to work, the POCO class has to have minimally a representation of every single scalar and navigation property that's in your entity. And then it can have anything else that it wants also after that, right? More business logic, other properties, custom properties, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So we don't care about those. And if you're trying to get that dynamic proxy, you don't have to mark those virtual. It's just the ones that match the entity. So it's actually two different types of POCO support. When we use code first, we're using the first kind where you have the clean classes and you don't have to mark them virtual. Because I can imagine there would be people who are saying, you know, well, I understand that you're not asking me to inherit from entity object or inherit from something in nHibernate, but you're still giving me a rule, right? These are my classes. I don't want you to tell me that I have to make those properties virtual because they're my classes. The POCO support swings both ways.
I think, like when I did mine, I made mine virtual. Just anyone who's ever worked with nHibernate, that's sort of expected there too.
That's the norm. See, I don't know.
And I mean, the other thing, if you want lazy loading, you have to mark these things virtual. And if you do not have lazy loading, you run into all sorts of obstacles in trying to really work with these things as POCOs and have clean tests
and clean business logic. That depends. That depends, because again, it's I think that has a lot to do with where you're coming from. Like, because if you're coming from a development environment or development where you're used to lazy loading, then yeah, you want that, and things don't, you know, without it, things don't work right, right? Because it's just what you're saying. And from my world, and I'm coming from like the data set world, and my expectation is whatever I asked for is what's there. So like the lazy loading to me, like it was something I had to get used to, because it kind of freaked me out that all of a sudden all these extra hits are getting made to the database and all these round trips. And I just needed to be so much more careful about what I was doing, because I wanted to make sure I knew, even if I was going to take advantage of the lazy loading, which believe me, I do in plenty of scenarios. I love having it as an option, but I really feel like I need to understand, you know, when I'm doing something that's going to accidentally cause 400 extra round trips to the database just because I was using lazy loading, right? And I try to kind of weigh those things.
Select N plus one is a big possible problem that you run into.
What do you mean? I don't know what that means.
Where you loop through employees that you brought back, and every time you touch the one of these lazy loaded collections on that employee object, you issue another select statement.
I think a really good example of that, and again, it from my perspective and my background, it's just, you know, this surprise of how it works. And a good example of it is when you're writing markup, like, you know, categories and products. And I've seen this a lot with like examples where you'll query for the categories and let lazy loading populate the products for you, right? You don't bother querying for the products. And as you're rendering the page and listing out, you know, 40 different categories, you're making this is the problem, without realizing it. It's for the people who don't realize that this is what's going on, that they've just made 40 extra round trips to the database. Mm-hmm. If you know that's what's happening, and that's how, you know, you've planned for it, and you know what your resources are, and you know how your performance is, that's great. It's just, for me, it's just all about knowing what's going on, knowing, you know, what's going on in the processes of your application and coding around that, instead of, I just don't like the magic stuff. I guess I'm anal that way, but I'm a programmer.
I had two questions that are kind of related. One is context lifecycle management for ASP.NET. Like I know, for instance, this was something on these webcams where I'd work with people that were building all kinds of applications, and generally we're pushing them towards Entity Framework, and people came up with all kinds of problems where, you know, it was very easy to write very simple things, but as soon as you wanted to use a repository pattern and you wanted to abstract away your data access, then you'd have maybe one method that would look something up and another that would update it, and then all of a sudden you're into problems with disconnected entities and reconnecting them.
Right.
And so one thing that I'd read about was the idea of a context per request, where you're doing something in begin request and you're just creating a, you know, an application wide context. And I thought, oh, that looks kind of ugly. But then not application scope. I mean, request scope. So it's going to go.
Oh, okay. Shoot.
But I was still thinking that seems a little weird. But then I noticed on TechPub, I believe it was on a TechPub thing that Ayende was doing with Rob, that they were doing that within Hibernite as well. So I was like, okay, maybe this isn't, you know, maybe this is something that is not necessarily bad and, you know, is at least something kind of standard. The first question, I guess, was, you know, what do you see people doing? What do you recommend for context management for those cases where you're going to have multiple, you know, where you've got to work around this disconnected entity problem?
Right. So rather than what I'm seeing people doing, I'd rather talk about what I recommend.
Because they're different.
Which is absolutely, you know, unless you're in a very, very controlled environment where you know you have three users, right? Three concurrent users is the max you're ever going to have, and you know what you're doing, and you've made the decisions. Definitely for any kind of disconnected stuff, short-lived context is the way to go, because you could just run into all kinds of problems. For example, say you have a web service and you've got 100 people making requests against operations in your service, and like a WCF service, and you have a single context that you're maintaining, because with in that scenario, you could make it static, right? And it could just be hanging around. So everybody's working against this one context and sending data up and getting updates and things like that. Well, anytime one of those 100 people triggers save changes on that context, the context is going to save changes for every single entity being managed. So everybody's work all of a sudden goes and persists to the database and comes back and is refreshed and unchanged. And so sharing that across multiple users, multiple processes could be really, really dangerous. And again, if somebody understands really well how all that stuff works and makes a determination that that's what they want to do, that's a different story. What I'm worried about is people using it without understanding what's going on.
So that makes sense for, short-lived context. What about in the ASP.NET world, like inside a web app? I've got a web application and I've got a lot of, MVC controller actions or web pages that are going to do short, they're only going to exist for the length of the request.
Well, spinning up a context itself is not terribly expensive once the application process is running. It's the first one is the one that's expensive, because that's when we're loading up all the metadata and doing things like that, any pre-compiled views, things like that that are happening. So this was actually a huge pain in the ass is that okay on Herding Code? Did I just?
It's actually required.
Okay. Yeah. Phew. I just, didn't want to harm my reputation here. It was a huge pain in the ass in the first version of Entity Framework. But there's a number of things in Entity Framework 4 that make this a lot easier to deal with, working with disconnected entities. And just for anybody who doesn't understand what the overall problem with disconnected entities is for Entity Framework, it's that the entities themselves are not aware of their state. All they know is, this is what my current value is, right? They just have values and that's all. It's the context that is keeping track of the state, and the context is responsible for not only the change tracking, but doing the actual persistence back to the database. So when your context is on the server and it sends entities back over to the client, all of a sudden those entities, the context is no longer managing those entities, right? They're completely disconnected. So that was really hard to deal with in Entity Framework 3.5. So there's a few things that were added to 4 along with the POCO support. But there are a few things that are added to 4 that make life a lot easier. And it's some additional methods to have much more control over state. So when you reconnect an entity, or when you attach an entity to a context, so an entity's come back across a process and you spun up a new context and you're attaching it, right? So in 3.5, once you've done that attach, you had a lot of decisions to make about what was going to be the smartest and most efficient and really just the best way to discover what the state of the entity was. Because, when it's attached, all it knows was, I just got this entity. It doesn't know, it was in the database. I got it before. It went over to the client. The client made this change and that change and then sent it back. It doesn't know any of that. So it just says, it's an entity, right? And when you go to save changes, it doesn't know that it needs to do anything. It just says, well, there's nothing to do with this one because nothing has happened to it since you attached it to me. So there's nothing to do at all. So there's some new methods where you do have control of state. You can say, oh, that was modified or that was updated. You have control over being able to assign state to an entity. And once you've done that and the context has some awareness of the fact that this was updated or this was inserted or this was deleted, then when you call save changes, the context knows what kind of commands to build and send to the database. So that's a huge thing because it was much more difficult to control the state of an entity before. You know, it's my application. I know what's going on. Let me tell Entity Framework what to do instead of Entity Framework saying, oh, well, you just gave this to me, so obviously I don't have anything to do with that. I want to be able to say, no, damn you, I want you to modify this and send an update command. So that's half of it. The other half for me is the POCO support, because what I'm doing with my POCOs is I'm adding in a new property that is a state flag. So as long as the client who's using my entities changes that state flag for me so that I know if something is modified or inserted or unchanged or deleted, and then I send it back over to the server, now I know exactly what I need to do with it. Because before, I had to play a guessing game. Oh, the ID's 0? Well, probably that's inserted. So I'll go ahead and insert it, right? Crossing my fingers. Or, oh, there's already an ID in there. Well, it must have been in the database before in order for it to have some kind of an ID. So obviously I have to modify it, right? So you had to play a guessing game. Or you had to go back up to the database and get a fresh set of data and then do some comparisons, right? And do updating and things like that. So my pattern that I'm using, whether I'm using it in MVC, and I'm using this in my repositories. So whether I'm using MVC or I'm using WCF services, I've got POCOs, and in my POCOs, they have a local state property and the client is responsible. The client has to honor a contract if they want to use my entities and they want to use my services. And part of that contract is they have to update that state property so I know what the hell to do with that entity when it comes back to the service or, you know, to the server code of an MVC application. So there also is one other thing that Microsoft gave us, which is something called self-tracking entities. And there's a template that's in the box with the RTM called the self-tracking entities template. And that will create POCOs, but they're very specific POCOs, and they actually have a lot of intelligence for notification built in, but not notification back to the server, just notification to themselves so that they keep track of when changes are made. And then when those entities come back across the process and go back to the server has some methods that know how to read through graphs and how to figure out what the state is for everything and then go ahead and do updates. A couple of big red flags for me on those. I think that the self-tracking entities are awesome for people who have been using data sets and using data sets with services and just want it to be as easy as it was with data sets. So I think these are great for that category, that group of developers. But for me, the downsides are they're not interoperable because you need to have, well, it's easiest if these classes have to be on the client side for them to work, to keep track of their changes. So the client side has to be .NET, and most easily to use them, it has to be .NET 4 because some interface that's used moved into a different namespace between 3.5 and 4. So that creates a problem, but there's a way to get them to work with 3.5. But still, so it's not really very interoperable. And the other thing is that it's really designed right now out of the box to work with WCF, not with ASP.NET. So it's really designed for WCF services because there's some dependency on how data contract serialization works for them to work when you get over to the server side. So there's some work that the team is starting to do to come up with suggestions or a new template, right? Maybe some new templates so that you can use them when ASP.NET. But God, the first time I saw those, I was like, oh, I'll be able to, you know, solve my caching problems. I'll be able to use those for caching, like, you know, kind of second level caching. I'll be able to use them in websites. apps. I'll be able to use them in services. And they're like, oh, no, these were written for services. Sorry. You know, we sat down and talked about it. And they, you know, once that understanding of the fact that we're dependent on the data contract serialization to do the real heavy lifting there, then it was, you know, kind of, yeah, this is really, really good for WCF services. But we can't really use them for all those other things yet.
Yeah, that is too bad. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, POCOs, I mean, really, I've and I'm not the only one who's doing this, but POCOs with nothing more than just one flag in there, you know, one enum in there that says added, unchanged, modified, deleted, along with the new change management methods that so you can change the state. I'm doing everything I need with those, with MVC, with services. So that's really the combination of those two things has really given me a lot of power and a lot of control. That's what it's all about, right? Having control
yeah.
of everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. We are out of time. I did have
Were we out of time an hour ago?
We were out of time a long time ago. But
we got more questions.
We have so many more questions, but we're just going to have to, I don't know. We'll have to have you back on when EF hits version 16, which will be like by December, right?
Right. But I'm not writing another book. That's enough.
That's enough. So I do want to ask you, though, do you have anything exciting coming up? Anything you want to tell us about? Any appearances?
Well, there's that book.
The book I'm
working really hard right now going through the last reviews. I wrote... I'd love to say the book. I wrote a book about Entity Framework called Programming Entity Framework, and I wrote that for version 1. That came out beginning of 2009. And it's big. It's 800 pages long, and it was really a lot of work, and I said I'd never do it again. But then I started seeing what was coming out with Entity Framework 4, and I knew I had to because it was so much different. So I've completely rewritten the book. It's still 800 pages long. I thought it would be so much shorter because there was a lot of things that were easier. However, there's all the new stuff, all the POCOs and repositories and all the cool new things you can do. So it's still 800 pages long. And that's coming out in August, which is just, you know, it should be out in about a month, I think. So, yeah, I just got through a whole bunch of travel and finishing up the book. It's been a lot of work, so I'm really looking forward to just hanging out in Vermont for the summer. I would love to say, and just doing nothing, but of course there's tons and tons of stuff to do. What else am I doing? Oh, well, Scott, you know, I'm, or should I say, okay, Scott, I'm doing a bunch of the Pluralsight videos, which is a lot of fun. Pluralsight worked with MSDN, and MSDN has a whole bunch of those videos on MSDN Data Developer Center also, and they're like 10 to 15 minute long intro entity framework videos, and I'm going to do some more. Those have been a lot of fun to do. I really like them.
And that's just, it's msdn.microsoft.com/data, right?
Oh, even simpler. Yeah, even simpler, you can just do msdn.com/data/videos.
Ah.
And the videos are right there. But they're also on Pluralsight. Yeah, so, you know, working on articles and data points. The fun part for me about doing the MSDN Magazine Data Points column is my challenge to myself every month is to try to find something to write about that isn't Entity Framework, right? Because otherwise it would be Entity Framework column every single month. So that's been fun. It's been making me look at things like SQL Azure tables and OData and RIA services and things like that. So I'm having a lot of fun with that. So that's it, guys.
Awesome. I think we'll have to wrap it up then.
Eventually.
Well, see, Rob Connery has pinged me, and he says he wants you to talk about your talk at NDC and the conversation that you had with him and Greg.
Young.
Miller. Young. What? I know too many
Young
Gregs.
Greg.
Miller, Young Greg.
Young. Let's just call him Young Greg.
Yes, Young Greg. Greg Young. But that would take a while, I think. That
well,
will be part two.
I can tell you just very quickly about the interesting things at NDC, because there was a lot of... I was in the domain-driven development track, which was kind of interesting. Both of my talks were right after talks by Eric Evans, and Eric Evans sat in on both of my talks. I was a little nervous about that. Eric's awesome, so I learned I didn't have to be nervous. And I spent a lot of time talking to Rob and talking to Greg and talking to Eric and also to Patrick Lowendahl, he's from Stockholm. And Patrick is somebody who is a domain driven developer who knows Entity Framework really well, which is a really good combination for me because, you know, I'm trying to make that bridge also. So yeah, I talked to all of those guys a lot while I was there, and I'm just getting more and more interested in kind of look, you know, not only am I getting interested in domain-driven development, but because of what I'm bringing to the table with the Entity Framework, I'm really interested in seeing how we can put it all together and where it works and where it doesn't work. And I'm actually going to go take Eric's class a full week, an immersion class in DDD at the end of September. I'm so excited about that in New York City. So yeah, there was a lot of discussion there. And, you know, and like I said, I do not have a problem with that whole, you know, alt.net just from the perspective of, hey, there's another way, you know, there's another way to look at programming and approach your development and approach your practices and still use .NET. So I love talking to those guys and learning from them. And once in a while, I actually can share stuff with them too. Does that give you enough to that question?
Oh, sure. Yeah, whatever. I don't know. I wasn't there. So he said your talk was great. So.
Oh, really? I don't. Actually, the interesting thing was after I did the talk, he said, that was really cool. And if I had done it, I would have approached it this way. And I listened to that and I was like, oh, that's the perfect way. I wish I had done it that way. But it's always like that. Well, I'm glad he liked it. All right.
We should wrap up. Dead. Somebody wake up K-Scott.
Oh, hello.
We haven't made it to the birds, though.
This is the second reference you made to the birds. What's the birds?
I have a bird clock in my office, and if I have the lights on, it chirps, but there's no lights on.
So you're just sitting there in the dark podcasting? That's so sad.
And so this is funny because...
Sad? No, it's creepy.
And Scott K. was waiting around. We would have waited for hours. You were going to stretch this thing out for hours waiting for those birds.
Hell, this is exciting. You should have seen my Saturday night. All right, I'm going to cut this off. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to this episode of Herding Code. Hope something. You come back next week. How's that?
That was the best outro ever.
I couldn't scare you way too much.
All right, so it's July 16th, and Scott Guthrie just wrote this enormous blog post about CTP4, and you've written a blog post, Julie, about CTP4, and so I just wanted to get back in touch with you and see if there's anything we wanted to update from our previous conversation.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about, but we're not going to do the hour all over again.
Oh, come on.
Well, I'm easy for an hour, that's for sure. So the CTP4, what the CTP is, just as a refresher, this is the Entity Framework Feature CTP, where the team is using the CTP to put things that they're working on for the next version of Entity Framework in .NET. I don't know if that's going to be for .NET 5 or if there's going to be a service pack for .NET. But so what we're seeing in this CTP, which is Community Technical Preview, is the stuff that they're working on, and they're giving us these bits so that we can play with them. And they work against Entity Framework 4. So you can't use these bits with Visual Studio 2008. Or .NET 3.5.
Okay, so a CTP is kind of similar to like an alpha or pre-beta or whatever. Kind of, it's pre-release and it's subject to change, and it kind of lets you start working with it. And then the other thing you said is it kind of adds on to existing features, so it doesn't...
Exactly.
Okay, so not like I'm uninstalling...
It's not standalone.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I actually saw somebody on Twitter, he got kind of confused about... because of the name, because it just happens to be 4, and so people are getting confused between CTP4 and Entity Framework 4 and .NET 4. And it's just a coincidence. There were the first CTP, the first entity framework feature, CTP, was released actually a year ago. It was last June. And then there was number two, and then there was number three, and now there's number four. So number four has actually, there's something new in it in addition to the code first. So in the past, it had code first in it. CTP4 also has the next iteration of code first, which has a lot of really cool changes to it. But it also has another piece in there, which is enhancements to the core API for Entity Framework. And one of the reasons they're putting that in there along with the code first is that we can take great advantage. The newest iteration of code first takes great advantage of some of these new features that they're working on for Entity Framework. So does that make sense? Is that clear?
Yeah.
How those puzzle pieces all fit together? Because I know there's some confusion around that. People think it's a new version of Entity Framework is now available and released, and that's not the case at all. So there's two things actually to talk about with this CTP, which are the core API changes and what's new for Code First, or what's changed for Code First. I'll just touch on some of the core API stuff first. What they've done is not so much added new features, but given us easier access to existing features. So a really, really critical class in Entity Framework is the object context. The object context is how we're able to construct queries, and that's what manages all of the entities while they're in memory and does the change tracking. And it's the object context that enables us to persist data back to the database. So it's a big, heavy class. It's got a lot of stuff in it. And they've given us a lighter weight version of it called the DB context. One of the assumptions I had made about DB context was that it must inherit from object context, but that's not the case at all. As a matter of fact, DB context has a property called object context, so you can get back to object context if you want. So it's a lighter weight class that has not only a lot less features exposed, the ones that are not as commonly used, but it does expose a couple of new interesting ones as well that just make life a little easier. And additionally, along with the new DB context, we have a simpler version of the object set. Object set was introduced in Entity Framework 4. It's kind of like a collection, and it lets you work with sets of entities. So an object set of customers or an object set of orders or whatever. I'm so creative when it comes to like random ideas for what you might have in your model, right? An object set of fish.
Right. A school of fish.
Oh, yeah. So, and again, the object set is, so, and anytime you're working with a set of entities, you're working through the object set. So when you're querying, you query against the object set. But also, it's like a collection, so you can add, you can manipulate that set. You can add to the object set or remove items from it. And the object set is a property of the context. So okay. So when you're working with a customer's object set, it's not standing alone. It's part of that context that's instantiated against your model. So With the new API stuff they're working on, there's a stripped down version of that. And there's a couple of cool things with the new, and that's called DB set. So it's still, they're using the set concept, but it's now DB set and DB context. DB set, a couple of things I really like about DB set is, first of all, object set doesn't have a public constructor. So the only way to create an object set is through a context. You have to use a method called createObjectSet. But DBSet has a constructor, so you don't have to do all that extra work. You can just say, okay, instantiate a new DBSet of customers, and it's done. As opposed to context.createObjectSet of customer type, blah, 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 blah.
Which, like you mentioned in your blog post, then you're able to put the code where it belongs instead of, you know, having that stuff scattered across your context.
Well, that's Well, that actually was something about Code First. So this is still the core API stuff, but because all of these things fit together. So for me, I just like how much easier it is to instantiate and obvious it is. And that's what these simpler classes do. They give us simpler access to a lot of the chores that we have to do in Entity Framework, and in some cases has made those tasks kind of take care of themselves where it makes sense for them to do that. So, you know, without getting into too many details, some of the key improvements that they're looking at for the core API are these simplified classes. And I know Chris Sells will appreciate one improvement here. This simpler DB set has more intelligently named methods. When Chris and I were working on our tech ed presentation, and one of the pieces of lines of code he had to use was customers.addObjectNewCustomer. And he kept saying, why do I have to say add object? I want to say just add.
Right.
So it's just, so they've just totally made it easier to work with. They haven't taken the context and the object context and the object set away. They've just put something simpler to access on top of them. So you don't have to have such a deep understanding of Entity Framework to work with them.
I found, you know, I really just, it's not like it's saving that many lines of code, but I found that
it's more discoverable.
Yeah. Instead of having to think like, okay, this is what Entity Framework wants me to do. It's, I can just think about this is what my code does, you know?
Right. And it kind of lines things up too. Like DB set is kind of like a collection, right? So it makes sense to have add and remove, not add object and delete.
Mm-hmm.
Or add object and delete object. Let's just put it in the terms of how I'm used to coding it. I don't have to think of this as, oh, this is Entity Framework and it's very special, so its syntax is different. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
There's another thing I really like about the object set, which is when you're working with inherited objects in your model, inherited entities didn't have their own object set. So for example, if I have contacts and I also have customers in my model and customers inherit from contacts, I always have to refer to the contacts set. So whenever I do a query, I have to say context.contacts of type customer,
mm-hmm.
Right? I can never get there. So the new object set lets me just get right to the set of whatever entities they are, regardless of if they're a base class or inherited. So that's really, really cool. I really like that. There's a ton of stuff in there. Let me jump over to Code First, because Code First not only got some new goodies, but they also simplified things enormously. I took my code sample from my book and revised it based on, it was from CTP3, so just the previous version of Code First, and I updated it to align with CTP4, and I cut out over half the code. I was so happy.
Wow.
So that's all that everybody likes to hear that, right? Oh, I wrote a whole application in 3 lines of code.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't quite that. So Code First, one of the things about Code First, and I'll just do a really quick overview of how that works. Entity Framework is totally dependent on the model, the XML that describes the model and all the metadata. And that's how it gets from your model as you describe it back to the database. It's really relying on this metadata at runtime. So most everything Entity Framework does, especially when it's interacting with the database, it reads all of that metadata. So Code First actually is a way to create a domain model. So you build domain classes. So forget the entity data model, forget the designer, forget the XML. It's all gone. All you have to do is write your classes the way you would normally write classes. And then Entity Framework at runtime will read those classes and infer the XML that it needs based on what it's discovering in those classes. And then it's therefore continues to be able to do all of that work back and forth with the database and going from the model to the database schema and back and forth. So, and that's all done by convention. but model first uses convention over configuration. So your classes aren't always going to line up with what entity framework needs in order to figure out what the model should look like. So you can actually configure on top of that additional tweaks. The example I used in my blog post that you read was, I have a class called Conference Track, and it's key property, it's tracking, it's identity property. The one that I want to use is called track ID rather than conference track ID. So that doesn't fall in line with a convention that Entity Framework or Code First expects, which is it's going to look for a field either called ID or, based on the name of the class, conference track ID. And it will use that to say, oh, well, that's going to be my entity key and my primary key in my database that I'm going to create for you if it doesn't already exist. And because my track ID doesn't fall into that, I can use configuration on top of the convention to say, oh, and by the way, the key for my conference track class is that property called track ID. You can use that instead because you're not going to find what you're looking for.
And the ways you pointed out to do that, one is in code where you can use the has key on the entity.
Right. And that lines up with what people are used to from Fluent Hibernate.
Okay. And then the other way you showed was using an attribute.
Exactly. And they're calling the attributes are referred to as data annotations.
Okay.
Because they're specific for that. But I always use the terms in tandem because if throwing in the new one, data annotations, people may not understand, oh, you're just talking about attributes. So you can put attributes right in your classes, whether it's something you describe on your on the class itself or on a property. So simply key as an attribute on my track ID property will give Entity Framework everything it needs to know. And the reason that there's both ways is, you know, a lot of people just want to use attributes because they're really easy. But then there are people who will not want to be putting this Entity Framework specific type of information into their classes, right? Because that's what you'd be doing is saying, well, I have my class, it's my class, but because I want it to work with Entity Framework, I have to make some modifications to the class. Now, they're not as painful as, you know, inheriting from entity object, but still some people are not going to want to put those Entity Framework specific attributes into their classes.
You know,
totally understood.
Yeah. One thing I was wondering here, I wouldn't want to do this, but occasionally I'll talk to people and they'll say, well, could I load this from XML or could I set these via a string or some kind of way so that it's because the has key is using a lambda, that's pointing to a property. Is it, you know, is there a way to do this via a string?
Well, there's always I only know the nickname for this. I forget the real term for it. There's something that people call the ugly buddy class.
Yeah.
And it's a way that you can use partial classes to add in annotations to other classes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's another name. It's something you'll see a lot in Rheos services code.
Yeah.
Because Rheos Services wants all these different annotations, even key is one of them.
I've ended up using that in MVC also because you end up using annotations for MVC and you don't want to change your entity model. So
what's the real name? Do you happen
remember? I've only heard that buddy classes. There's got to be something.
You haven't even heard ugly buddy.
Well, I always think it when I type it.
I heard that first from somebody at Microsoft. They're like, oh, you mean an ugly buddy? Buddy. Like, yeah, that describes it pretty well because it you know, it does have a bit of a code smell to it.
It does. It's so, kinda, yeah, when I'll show it to people, I'll say like, okay, I know this is kind of ugly, but I just put it in here and then it works. And you know. But yeah.
So that leads us to the other way to do configurations. And as a matter of fact, this way was available in the previous versions of Code First, and that's to do it in code. So there's something called a model builder, and you can access it in your context class because if your now this is how it kind of wraps around to the new core API stuff. If your context class inherits from this new DB context, DB context exposes a method called onModelCreating. So that's at the point in Code First when it says, oh, I've got some classes, domain classes here. I need to spin up some metadata on the fly. So at the So on code, on model creating, at that point, you can inject these configurations and say, oh, you're about to create the model? Wait, there's a couple more things I want you to know about how I want you to create this model. And then Model Builder has methods and this whole syntax for adding in that information. So you could say, oh, in that place, you can say, using Model Builder, you can say, for the conference track entity, I want you to know that you do have a key and it's called track ID. And that's all through IntelliSense and Lambdas and stuff. And I like that better. Me personally, I like that better than using the attributes because it keeps everything, to me, it keeps everything where it belongs. You know, the context has control over this. I don't need the classes to be defining those extra things the entity framework needs to know about.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's something that I like. I highlighted already, and in the blog post, I highlighted it because I like it a lot. And it also is one of the reasons that points back to why in this particular CTP, not only are we seeing code first, but we're seeing some of these new API things because code first takes advantage of them. So there's one last thing I want to point out. There's a whole bunch of cool things with code first, but I mentioned that I cut out a lot of code. And one of the reasons there was because the conventions have gotten a lot smarter. All the logic that is behind the convention part of entity frameworks assumptions or code first assumptions has gotten a lot smarter. One of the things that was really a pain to work with before was relationships. Even though relationships were defined in your classes, we still had to feed some very specific information, especially to get if you wanted two-way relationships, through configuration. So all that's gone away and it's able to look at your classes and figure out one-to-many relationships and many-to-many relationships and things like that. So that's big. That's actually, if this is your first time looking at code first, no big deal, right? It's like it works the way you'd expect it to work. But if you've been coming up through the previous CTPs, that's a really great, great change. I just wanted to point out.
Okay. Well, so Scott Guthrie had written a huge walkthrough of setting up code first with CTP4 and Nerd Dinner, and
I think they had to put a couple more servers at Microsoft to host just that blog post.
It's impressive.
Not only because it's so long, but also just based on what I'm seeing on Twitter, everybody is so excited about it. So, you know, I should just change my middle name to Scott.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't because there's already a Scott Galloway. So. Sorry.
Yeah, maybe hyphenated. I'll look into some options.
John Scott.
Well, I mean, one thing, like you said, I think he definitely highlighted that, you know, he's not writing any extra code, really. He's using DBSet and... You know, he's declaring in the DB context, he's declaring a DB set and then just kind of goes to work on it.
He's taking the most advantage of all these features because it's just so when you really use them at that very high level, there's so much power there without having to learn all this other stuff. And so his blog post is just a great example of how simple the new features, not just the new code first features, but these new things we're getting in the API are making Entity Framework to use. And you know what it does? It stops becoming about using Entity Framework.
Mm-hmm.
It just becomes about writing applications and, you know, hey, I'm going to write an application. I'm going to create some classes. Oh, I don't have a database yet. Sure, create the database for me. And I just want to go to town. And I don't want to have to write any data access code.
Well, speaking of all that, which I think is great. Yeah, I do think he really did a good job of, you know, obviously, but he really described that flow really well. But speaking of that, with the data automatically creating the database, I thought that was really interesting. We were talking about that a little bit before the call about some of the options he presented for how you can do that as far as not just... So I go through, I create my model, I say, yeah, go ahead, create my database. And then the thing that I thought was really interesting was, you know, how do I handle changes going forward?
Right. And that's always a big question when you're doing anything ORM-like, right? If I've got some kind of model, whether my model is described in, whether it's a domain model I'm describing in code, or it's a model like an EDMX that I'm describing in XML, and that somehow maps back to a database, how do I deal with changes? Whether the changes are in the model and you want to get them to the database, or the other way around.
Okay.
So with code first, there are a couple of ways to deal with this. But right now, they're still not pretty. They're easy, but they're still not pretty. And we have the same problem if we're working with model first. So I just want to back up a little bit and go down just the path a little bit of the different ways. If you're using a database first model, so you're using an EDMX in the designer that you created by reverse engineering the database, or it doesn't matter how you created it. If you're using a model that's in the designer and you make a change in the database, there is a feature of the Entity Framework Designer, and this has been there since Visual Studio 2008, since the first version of Entity Framework. You can say update the model from the database, and Entity Framework will have a wizard that goes through and looks at the schema of the database and figures out what you don't have yet and brings that into your model. So it goes that way really nicely. But if we're using model first or code first, where we want to make a change to the model, whether that model is a visual model in the designer or it's just a domain, your domain class is described in code, and you want to make changes to the database based on the schema changes you're making in your model, that's not so easy. Right now, with model first by default, and with code first, it really means one of two things. Either you need to go into your database manually and make those changes, or if you want to let the tools, the tooling the Entity Framework has to create databases, it's going to create a whole new database. It's going to delete your existing database and create a new database. This is, as for my purposes, as long as I know that's what I'm doing, this is perfectly fine, because if I'm in that iteration of designing and developing and doing something that's kind of fluid and I'm making those changes along the way, it's my expectation. And, you know, I'll have data that I can persist. Maybe I save it. It's all kinds of tools you can use to save SQL Server or whatever data off somewhere and then re-import it back in again. So I'll do stuff like that. Model first, I may have mentioned this already when we had this discussion previously. There's a power pack that's available from Microsoft that you can use with model first that will deal with the deltas in your model and update database schema on them. Currently, CodeFirst does not have a feature like that. So he mentions three things. He said you can manually update the database schema, which I said. You can manually delete the database file and then rerun. He has some code that says, hey, read my classes, create metadata, and please create for me a database so I can store my data if that database doesn't already exist. You can also, the third thing he lists is we can enable a feature of code first that automatically updates our database for us whenever we change our models. And what he's talking about there is just the capability of Entity Framework to go ahead and delete the database for you and recreate it. It doesn't update the database.
So that's not a migration type of system.
It's not a migration. And if I am wrong, and I looked at that, I was like, whoa, I didn't know you could do that. And I read through his description of that. And what I'm seeing in his description is just the tool. It looks like it's the same thing that I'm using, which is a code in code first that with a context, the DB context has some methods that will delete the database and recreate it for you. So I am 99.5% sure that's what he's talking about. I'm actually 100% sure, because he does have a note in there that says we're working separately to provide a better data migration support for scenarios where you've got production data and you do need to do versioning. So I'm looking at that thinking, well, I've seen that they've got some work on that for the power pack for Model First. So they'll that's probably or potentially related to what this is. So I'm always afraid that I've missed something when I'm saying absolutely, but
right.
So I'm like looking. But I'm pretty sure that just the way he expresses that is just a little confusing, because I don't think it's updating the database in terms of making changes to the schema. I think he means update by it's going to wipe out your database and create a new one for you.
Okay. Well, let me see. We should probably wrap up because we've been talking for a while and we already had recorded a long show, so I'll need to edit to get the time.
Didn't my agent tell you about that problem? 1 minute equals 30 minutes.
Right. Well,
it's a big topic.
It's huge.
You've seen how fat my book is. You know what the one nice thing is? I do have, not the one nice thing, there's a lot of nice things about this, but I was really lucky because I do have a small section in my book on Code First. It's not too big because it's still totally evolving, and I didn't want to put too much in there about it. But I was so happy the CTP4 came out just before I'm headed to the printer, so I got to revise those 7 pages to at least update them for CTP4 instead of CTP3. So that was good.
Thanks, team. Yep. Cool. Okay. Well, so is there any last things you want to mention here, or should we wrap up?
No.
Okay.
I think that's it. That awesome. Was the last thing. This last half hour was the last thing.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you.
CTP4.
Yep. Thank you very, very much for taking the time. I just, you know, after having just talked to you, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, we were up to date when we published the podcast. So.
Yeah. Oh, I'm happy to do it.
Okay.
Especially when it's not in the middle of the night.
Right.
All right. Have a great weekend, John.
You too. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay.
So I was at, I just have to tell you, I was at a PHP meeting the other night. It was a really great small PHP group here in Burlington, Vermont, where
I
live.
Did you get lost in the directions?
No, they're my friends. Anyway, they were talking, the focus of the meeting was on document databases, so like MongoDB, etc. I let them know about RavenDB also, by the way, which is, you know, a new .NET document database. And they were talking, the guy who was presenting, Matthew Weir O'Finney, was talking about a little bit of the history of PHP and got into, you know, oh, and then we got objects. And then he started talking about plain old PHP objects, but they don't have an acronym yet, right? So, you know, there's POJOs and there's POCOs. And so I have a friend who's, she's German and she has a little kid, and she's all the term of endearment for her little girl's behind is Popo. That's in German. That's a term of endearment. So
that's a term of endearment here that we have for police officers as well.
I heard that because I was looking it up like on Wikipedia or something. I heard that. Saw that one also. But so this guy's I just thought of this because we're talking about POCOs, right? These guys are they're, you know, this is their big dilemma. Like, what are they going to use for the acronym for plain old? Because right now they're just calling them plain old PHP objects. So anyway, there's a lot of .NET people who thinks it's POCO stands for plain old C# objects. I always try to correct them on that one.
Well, I have another question.
But you actually want to talk about Entity Framework now, not PHP?
It's actually EF, yeah.
Okay.
You say
I get around.
Okay. Wait till I ask it.
All right. Well, it was fun, guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you
for having me and let me blather on about Entity Framework or PHP, whatever.
I think they should be called POFPOs. POPHPO.
Well,
POFPO.
That's what they're leaning towards, POFOs, because POPOs really is, you know, a German term of endearment for a baby's bottom.
That's awesome.
So I was like, "Oh, you're gonna call them popos? Do you know what that means?"
Where's the popo police thing? Is that a Southern California thing?
No, I've heard this. It's
saw that because I was looking for a link like on Wikipedia or something, and I saw that it had both things on it. It had the, something oh, about no. the...
Actually, sorry. The link I sent.
German.
Don't look at... there's the first one I got. Sorry about that. But yeah.
But so if you're doing these things in F-sharp, are you doing F-sharp unconnected CLR objects so they're f***s?
Try again.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to the Urban Dictionary link.
It's...
Yeah. Rule number one.
Jeez. You have to
see. You never know with the Urban Dictionary, but it generally is.
Semi-ac. You have to not, you know.
Well, how appropriate do you think that is posts? For the PHP community?
Right.
No, the Flash. That should be for the Flash community.
Oh, here's a better. This is Wikipedia list of slang terms for the police officer. And it's in that list. You do have to scroll way down. There's maybe 400.
Oh, but in Hawaii, it refers to one's grandmother. That's sweet.
Popo. A term used commonly by North American youth and rap artists.
Got to go see my popo. She down Lahaina way. Well, yeah.
You know, maybe there's the same thing for pogo if we look hard enough.
I'm sure. Yeah.
The mustached pagoda. There's some funny ones in here.
Wow. Oh, there was a band called Pogo that was some of the guys from Buffalo Springfield.
Yeah.
There we go.
There's quite a few. Babylon, Jamaican Sparks. Term for corrupt establishment system, often applied to police. And of course, bacon. I'd never heard that before, but.
I can't answer these questions. Pete's yes. The others.
Okay.
They can send emails to Microsoft. I'm not Microsoft.
So my question's going to be easy. You'll be able to feel that, no problem.
Oh, about Node.js. Yeah, I'm all covered. I studied all up on that.
No, that's not my question.
Oh.
It'll be easy. But you should learn Node.js.
Everyone should learn Node.js.
My free time. I heard your dry cleaner's learning Node.js.
Everyone is going to learn it. Trust me. You'll be running that stuff off your Windows Live Active Mobile Phone 8.
Series
7, yeah.
They should have called it Episode. Episode is so much more fun than Series. I mean, that's just me.
With a pithy little name after it, like, you know, Revenge of the Jedi or Revenge of the Sith. Yes.